Good afternoon. Although the structure of this course means that only about one-third of Michelangelo's 75-year career is included, the immensity of what he achieved in 25 years will require three lectures to introduce. I remarked of Leonardo da Vinci that even genius has to have a beginning, i.e. a mentor. Vasari, in his biography of Michelangelo, had no doubt that the artist received his talents directly from God, who, quote, graciously looked down on earth and decided to have Michelangelo born a Florentine to perfect the artistic achievements for which Florence was already renowned. Well, of course, Vasari was a friend and an adoring disciple of Michelangelo, and he was writing in the middle of the 16th century. He wasn't born in the Quattrocento, but nonetheless he's looking back at the Quattrocento and recalling the artistic accomplishments that had made Florence a renowned artistic center. So his praise was in part a historical view, which would have been unlikely one or two centuries earlier, and in part a reflection of a new view of genius, of a divinely inspired artist. I might interject that we have the same thing with Leonardo. And with Leonardo and Michelangelo, we are dealing with figures who were regarded in their own lifetime at a different level and in a different way than artists before them had been, even the very great artists. It is a change in concept. It is a change in the way artistic production is regarded and in the way that artists are regarded. And it is something we will touch on during the coming lectures. Vasari conceded that Michelangelo was apprenticed to Domenico Ghirlandaio at the age of 14, but the idea of the divine Michelangelo was already established long before his death. Vasari did emphasize that his hero made careful copies of Masaccio's frescoes in the Brancacci Chapel, and that his Madonna of the Stairs was in the style of Donatello. So there was an acknowledgement of earlier influence. Michelangelo Buonarroti was the family name. Michelangelo Buonarroti was born in 1475 in Caprese, a village some 40 miles due east of Florence, near to Arezzo and even nearer to Sansepolcro, the home of Piero della Francesca. Michelangelo lived nearly 90 years, dying in 1564. Never married, he remained in close contact with his family, whom he frequently supported for most of his life. Since I remarked on how Leonardo's name should be said, Leonardo or Leonardo da Vinci, but never da Vinci, I will say that with Michelangelo it is a different situation. He is sometimes called Buonarroti, usually by Italians, and usually after Michelangelo has been established. But since it's his family name, that's all right to do. More often, however, he is Michelangelo. And by the way, the pronunciation in Italian would be Michelangelo. Michelangelo is perfectly acceptable in English, and you'll hear me do both, and probably something in between. As a boy of about 14, having already served his apprenticeship to Ghirlandaio, Michelangelo came under the protection of Lorenzo de' Medici. He lived in the Medici Palace. He studied in workshops that Lorenzo had established in the Medici Gardens, gardens that no longer exist. They were near San Marco. And there, amid a collection of ancient sculptures owned by the Medici, which were there to study for him and for other young artists, and the conversation of Renaissance humanists who were friends of the Medici and associates of the Medici, and the instruction of older artists and the fellowship of younger artists like himself, he found himself in a sort of academy for aspiring artists. It's called that, usually, and yet we know very little about it, in fact. We have very few details, but it seems to have been a remarkably rich and nurturing situation, one in which not just the skill of making sculpture or painting was taught, but rather the intellectual basis of it. and the classical foundations of it in classical art. All of those were there, and there was a large degree of freedom and experimentation. You weren't bound at that point by the demands of a patron, but you could do your own work. Materials were supplied, and so forth. It was quite a fine and auspicious beginning for a boy in whom great talent, high intelligence, and religious devotion were all evident. One of his early works is the relief, which you see on the screen now. The relief is called the Madonna of the Stairs. The Madonna of the Stairs was carved about 1491. It is in the museum called Casa Buonarroti, the House of Buonarroti today. And it is an image of the, I think we could call it the brooding Madonna. He was perhaps 16 when he carved this, and it is very comparable in its style, the low relief style of carving, to the low relief carvings of Donatello. For example, and it's the main example that I have shown you, the St. George and the Dragon, which was on the niche underneath the statue of St. George on Or San Michele. And Donatello had invented that low relief carving called Schiacciato in Italian. He'd invented it, and now we have Donatello being emulated by Michelangelo in this style. The spirit of the piece, on the other hand, the mood, the projection that it puts out may be already called Michelangelesque. It's monumental and brooding. It has a feeling quite unlike the sculpture of Donatello, the sheer weight of it. This Madonna fills the height of the panel from top to bottom. She, in her solemnity, also anticipates some of the Sibyls whom we'll be seeing that he painted on the Sistine ceiling. Those female prophetesses, well, that's redundant, those female prophets or prophetesses from the pagan world whom he painted on the ceiling. And she has this prophetic appearance, and she also has the scale and the weight of those figures. Here, as a teenager, he's created this already. It's been suggested, and you know, we often get into these... And we certainly will hear for a moment into the subtleties of interpretation. Partly it's what you see, and partly it's what you can bring to bear on it, and what he brought to bear on it, what we know that he could have known in interpreting these. The Madonna is of a type called the Madonna Lactans, a suckling Madonna. She is suckling the child. But is she? She raises her cloak as though she were suckling the child. But if you look closely at the child, he's limp almost, although that's a very broad back. But if you look at the position of his right arm behind him and of his head, he looks more as though he's asleep. And if you interpret it that way, you have not only the potential idea of the suckling Madonna, but also that image that we've seen before in Madonna and Child paintings, in which the child, the death, the ultimate death of Christ, is suggested even in the Madonna and Child, lying there, in this case not lying but being held, and rather limply by the Madonna. On the other hand, to return to the idea of the suckling child, you may have read that Michelangelo was given a wet nurse when he was an infant. And the wet nurse came from a family of stonecutters. And he placed great importance by this in his later life. He said that he imbibed his ability to carve stone from his mother's breast, from his wet nurse's breast. And he didn't say it lightly. He didn't say it as something humorous. The stairs, which give this its title, on the left, five steps going up quite steeply, quite shallowly, in the sense that they really are quite close to the pictorial surface, though the figures on them do seem to be smaller in proportion to their assumed place in space. But the stairs may well, almost certainly do, have some symbolic meaning. They may be there to suggest the ladder that was placed against the cross at the crucifixion. The children, who are wingless, but Michelangelo's angels usually are, may be meant to be angels. And indeed, if you look at the largest, most prominent one, you see that it is holding end of a cloth, and the end of the cloth continues over here, where a hand of an angel, and in fact a head, I think, appear here, and it is being held on that side. Well, what kind of a cloth? Probably a shroud, Christ's winding sheet. So again, as we've seen so often, in the image of the Christ child, you have the suggestion of the sacrifice of Christ. The steps may mean more than that, or something in addition to that, because symbolism is not exclusive. It can mean more than one thing. You can have a whole group of ideas coalescing into an image. For instance, there was a medieval text that was widely known at the time, attributed to St. Augustine, in which Mary is compared to the stairs by which God descended in the person of Christ to mankind, and by the same stairs we mortals can ascend to heaven, to salvation afterward. And in 1477, a book was published which was so popular that it was in a third edition just about the time this was carved, and the book was called Stairway to Heaven. So these images, these ideas, and especially in the milieu in which Michelangelo had fortunately been placed, an intellectual, not just a studio or workshop milieu, these ideas could well have played their role here. There are places where he's still a young artist. The right foot of the Madonna crossing under, it doesn't work too well, I suppose. It's a little awkward, but it's an interesting idea as he crosses her feet. She sits on a very square block, almost like a building block, like a foundation block, and that could also, for reasons that are pretty apparent, become a have Christian symbolism or theological symbolism in this painting, in this sculpture, pardon me. The Bacchus takes us a little by surprise, I think. The Bacchus was carved between 1496 and 1498. It is a supple and rather fleshy figure of Bacchus, and a little bit of a surprise because you think, well, here he is, he's been studying ancient sculpture, he wants to emulate ancient sculpture, but he creates something that has relatively little parallel in ancient sculpture in terms of the tipsiness, if I can put it that way, of this Bacchus. Now, Bacchus is a complicated figure, as you know. Bacchus is, and is called, he's known as Dionysus in Greek, and sometimes that is a more suggestive term because one thinks of Dionysian rites and so forth. But whether he's Bacchus or Dionysus or Bacchus Dionysus is not important, but he is a figure who is associated with various rituals. Here he's accompanied by a faun here at the lower right behind him. So I'll show you an image in which you can see the front view of the faun here. Bacchus in his right hand holds a cup. In his left hand, he is clutching a kind of flayed skin, probably from a leopard, is the usual interpretation because it's associated with him. And in that skin supports large bunches of grapes, which the faun is eating. It's probably meant to be a suggestion of life in death because grapes are associated with the Christian sacrament, and the flayed skin of the animal speaks for itself. The tipsiness is quite wonderful because he really has caught it so marvelously. The figure seems barely able to support himself. Let me show you a closer detail of the extraordinary little faun. And by the way, remind you that when he carved this, that faun looks like just a lovely figure. It's out of the same piece of marble, and of course it's a large part of the support of the figure. Marble doesn't have a lot of tensile strength, and so you've got to have something to support, and frequently they'll put a tree trunk or something behind a figure. Here he uses that part of the marble, turns it into the supporting and wonderfully evocative faun here. The astonishing facility with which Michelangelo carved stone does seem to be an innate gift. He studied with no significant sculptor, one minor sculptor, but nobody of importance, and he nurtured this innate gift through the study of earlier Renaissance sculpture, but more importantly, ancient Roman sculpture as well. His Bacchus was carved in Rome, not in Florence, though he had already done a wonderful little Cupid, or Eros, which he did in the antique style and buried it for a week or two so that it would get stained in the soil, and then passed it off as an ancient carving. And he fooled them. He sold it as a piece of ancient work. Here, I think we have something that would not be mistaken for ancient art because it has such a different feeling. And yet, it is a pagan god, and in time, Michelangelo would fuse pagan antiquity with the Christian faith in an original unity of intellectual and emotional power. Bacchus is the god of wine, but he's also a fertility god. He's often depicted as soft and fleshy, as he is here, and his lassitude is a symbol of sensual indulgence, in contrast, for instance, to the rational control of the god Apollo. I'd like to spend more time with him, but we'll bring him back in another context later. Let me move to his next work in Rome. Between 1498 and 1499, in a very short period of time, he carved this famous Pietà, which was carved for a chapel in St. Peter's and which is still in St. Peter's, though not in the same chapel. It was commissioned by a French cardinal and ambassador to Rome, whose name was Jean de Billaire. Jean de Billaire for his burial chapel in St. Peter's. That chapel was later destroyed in the process of rebuilding St. Peter's, necessitating the relocation of the sculpture, eventually ending up in the front, the first chapel on the right-hand side when one enters the basilica. The theme of Mary supporting her dead son originated in Northern Europe and spread to Italy. Northern examples tended to emphasize the suffering of Christ and the anguish of the Virgin. But Michelangelo created a classical Stoic group. The composition is a broad-based pyramid, a High Renaissance grouping. It possesses in itself a sense of serenity and of nobility. But the emotional impact comes from the angular, broken body of Christ laid above this massive groundswell of the Madonna's cloak below. It is the most wonderful and startling composition. It is his first great religious sculpture. It is a visual dirge. It is a poignant lament sung over a sustaining ground bass. And to me at least, it is newly heartrending at every encounter. If you look at the Madonna and the wonderful cowl, the very delicate detail of her face, the beautifully worked garments of her torso, which are so finely carved, so carved with such detail, descriptive detail. There's a higher degree of surface polish on this piece than in any work he ever did, I think, and more descriptive detail as well. It's also his only signed work, and the story is, and one tends to believe it, that he was looking at it one day, and some people came in, and somebody said, "Who did that?" And another person said, "Oh, so-and-so from Gubbio," and Michelangelo knew it wasn't so-and-so. So he came in when the church was closed and signed his name on the sculpture at that time. It is his, I think, his only signed piece of sculpture. The youthfulness of Mary has always attracted comment. According to Condivi, who was Michelangelo's biographer and amanuensis almost, he had the biography dictated to him, Michelangelo explained that chaste women always kept their freshness longer, and that the Virgin Mary's flower of youth was preserved so that the virginity and eternal purity of the Mother of God could be demonstrated to the world. But the Son of God was made incarnate, and it was better that he should appear to have the age that he really had. We have to accept that, I think, as what Michelangelo intended. I have never been bothered by it, as some have throughout the centuries, because I find that it lends such a... the delicacy of the Madonna and her youth lend a particular poignancy to it. I don't think of it in naturalistic or realistic terms, but rather in the sense of sorrow and loss, and I think it enhances that. And looking at it again and looking at that great sweep of lower drapery, which is just so extraordinary in its expressiveness. You can hear it. It resonates so. Back in Florence in 1501, he was soon given the opportunity to finish an over-life-size figure, which had been begun by another sculptor nearly 40 years earlier. It was abandoned because it was a shallow piece of marble and the sculptor just couldn't work with it. It was a mammoth piece of stone, and it was very difficult, and so it had been put aside. He got the commission to complete it, and it was begun almost certainly as a David, and of course as David it was completed in 1504. Michelangelo was able to surmount the difficulties that it created. His David is twice life-size. David is a symbol of Florence, one of its guardians, not precisely a patron saint, but one of its guardians. But we're accustomed to Davids, we've seen three, who are young boys, life-size, or even less. Donatello, Verrocchio, Castagno, those three Davids. Why is this one so huge? Well, for one thing, originally the figure had been intended for installation high on a buttress of the cathedral, where it had to be seen from a great distance below, so it had to be large. It had to be large to carry to the ground. But size aside, where the Virgin of the Pietà that we just saw is surprisingly young, so this David is more mature, not just larger, but more mature than the biblical child hero that we've seen before. And it has been shown, I think convincingly, that Michelangelo fused two heroes, both of whom were emblems of the Palazzo Vecchio, the city hall, and by extension emblems of the Florentine Republic established after the expulsion of the Medici in 1494. They were David and Hercules, and of course the physique of this figure is very much that of Hercules, while the iconography of it, the way the subject of it, is clearly David. When the completed David was seen, it was instantly acclaimed, placed in front of the Palazzo Vecchio instead of on the buttress. And it stayed there for a long time, and for the 19th century with a canopy over it to protect it. Nonetheless, of course, it was not wearing well under the elements and has for a long time been in the academy, the academia, in a gallery of its own, where it is surrounded by tourists as though it were in the middle of a subway rush hour, but at least it's above their heads. Let me describe it for just a moment. One is always struck in this work by the size of the head and the size of the hands, and they could have been that size to carry further, the idea being on the buttress, so you make those features larger to carry further. They could also have had a reference, a very specific reference to things which are to this day on the Capitoline Hill. That is to say, fragments of colossal statues. There is a colossal head and a colossal hand there today, and they could refer to that. Moreover, there is Pliny the Elder's description in the Wonders of the Ancient World of the Colossus of Rhodes. And in that description, it specifically says that a man couldn't encircle the thumb with both arms. And there were prints made showing the imaginary Colossus of Rhodes, which no longer existed. So that could have worked into this as well. And I might say one quick word about contrapposto. Contrapposto. It means simply putting something against, placing against, pushing against. In this case, with the body, it means putting all the weight on one leg, letting the other leg, as it is here in the David, be relaxed. That throws one hip out and throws the body into an S-curve at the same time. It also throws the shoulders out of line. It introduces movement. It introduces the possibility of action and of interaction. And when you take it a step further and twist the body, which he does not really here, only the head, but if you twist the body on its hips and shoulders into two different planes and introduce that kind of torsion, a contrapposto has been moved to another level. It is something that the ancient world had discovered and was being redeveloped by artists during the Renaissance. Let me compare just briefly here, the David with the Bacchus. Do you see how similar they are in one sense? The poses are very similar. Right hand and left hand are reversed in a way. But one of them holds one hand high, the other hand at the side. They are both in contrapposto poses with the weight supported on one leg only. And how fascinating it is that by just a few changes, uh, you you, instead of having this figure full of lassitude, in which all the curves are a little full and a little flabby and so forth, and everything just relaxes a shade too much and the head falls, the neck turns out of its axis, just by making a few changes, you get this hero. You get this extraordinary, upright, and irresistible hero of David. Michelangelo, throughout his career, shows a remarkable ability to play variations on the human body and take a same pose and do something quite different with it just through adjustments of this kind. Like the Mona Lisa, the David has suffered the indignity of countless parodies and been packaged in plastic replicas, including the tiniest possible. He's been marketed as a refrigerator magnet with interchangeable outfits of pants and shirts, and worse. But still, that watchful head on that tensed neck is the actual embodiment of protective watchfulness. Michelangelo was a painter, but it wasn't his favorite occupation. He wanted to be a sculptor more often and resisted painting. However, this is the only panel painting by Michelangelo which is unquestionably his. There are two or three other works which have been claimed for him. They may be authentic. If so, this one remains the only finished example of his early forays into painting. It's a powerful and complex image whose exact meaning is unclear. It's often called the Doni, D-O-N-I, Doni Tondo, and was made about 1534. It is believed to have commemorated the wedding of Agnolo Doni and Maddalena Strozzi, and the original frame here bears their coats of arms. It's superbly heroic, a tightly intertwined holy family adapted to this circular format with extraordinary skill. The Joseph is behind, the Madonna seated on the ground in a pose you certainly have never seen associated with the Madonna before, and one which doesn't suggest Madonna, the holy family pose at all. And the Joseph seated behind her, his legs straddling her, and he hands the Christ child, as it were, to her over her shoulder. Behind them is a wall-like enclosure containing the child John the Baptist looking up at the family and nude male figures behind him, whose significance has been debated. They might, I think, be interpreted as figures awaiting baptism and admission to the realm of the new law on this side of the wall and its promised salvation. And, of course, the Baptist, the child Baptist, is the in-between figure in this event. If this is so, then they're akin to those nudes we saw in the Adoration of the Magi by Fra Angelico and Filippo Lippi, the nude standing on a ruined wall beside a Roman archway in that painting. The bright and startling palette, the orange here abutting rose, unbelievable colors but very strong, heralds the colors that today are visible on the restored Sistine ceiling, and to me leave any doubt aside that these are the colors that were from the beginning we should have expected to find on the Sistine ceiling. The Bruges Madonna, 1503 to 1505, is an exquisite sculpture. It is direct and touching in its dignity, its simplicity, its unity of form. It was carved soon after his return to Florence, and it's the only sculpture by Michelangelo that he sent out of Italy. It was either commissioned by or purchased by a Flemish wool merchant in Florence, who placed it in a chapel of the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Bruges, where it remains today. The compact composition, in which the standing child is completely enclosed by the mother's body, is so touching, and it's at once warmly maternal and theologically symbolic. Nothing could be more winning than the relationship between mother and child here, it seems to me. And yet, the solemnity that pervades their features and the slow rhythms of the enveloping drapery discloses the deeper conception of this work. We have seen something similar in concept before in Donatello's Virgin and Child enthroned on the high altar in the Santo in Padua. Here as there is the suggestion of birth, of the enclosure even of the womb. In Donatello's Madonna, It was expressed with a kind of Byzantine stylized oval or mandorla around the Christ child. Here it's expressed through the arrangement of the Madonna's drapery, far more naturally, far more humanly. And where Donatello had responded primarily to the theological resonance of the Madonna and child, Michelangelo responds first to the feelingly human woman and child, and secondarily to the symbolic aspect. The work that Michelangelo accomplished by the time he was 30, would have sufficed to ensure his reputation forever, since they included two works whose immediate fame has never waned, the St. Peter's Pietà and the David. And yet, this was only the beginning. Thank you.